should like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together.
Jimmy Webb's name is synonymous with American songwriting. He has written numerous multi-platinum selling songs, including Up, Up and Away.
Up, up and away, my beautiful, my beautiful.
Wichita lineman.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road.
Galveston.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing.
And MacArthur Park.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance.
His hits span genres from country to pop to disco to hip-hop. He holds a rare position in the world of popular music, both composer and lyricist for all of his works. He is the only artist to have won Grammy Awards in music, lyrics, and orchestration, and the youngest person ever to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. His musical collaborations are as varied as his songs and include Glenn Campbell, Frank Sinatra, Art Garfunkel, The Fifth Dimension, Linda Ronstadt, Barbara Streisand, and Kanye West. He writes about it all in his new memoir, The Cake and the Rain, which is out now and published by St. Martin's Press, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jimmy Webb to the roundtable this morning. Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's my honor to be here. Thanks.
At what point did you figure it was time to tell your story and to write the memoir?
I think that as you approach 70, you begin to get a new perspective on life, and you know, one of those perspectives is that you can see that the end is coming, not to be maudlin about it. Also, you have quite a lot to look back on. I think that you see with more clarity the twists and turns of your story, and maybe you can even determine whether it's a story that's worth telling or that someone else might be even slightly interested in. So I got to that point. I felt that I wanted to unburden myself on some issues regarding my own behavior and also what I regard as kind of my, I hate to use the word, but my struggle to define myself as a member of my own generation in the 60s when it was very easy to be pigeonholed as a middle-of-the-road person, a person who was not a supporter of liberal ideas and might even be with the other side and in favor of the war in Vietnam and all this stuff. The polarity, I would call it, in the music business. And I go into that in some detail because it affected my life.
How much do you think it has to do with, we're talking to you from, you are in Tulsa, Oklahoma as we speak. So this is, you were born in Oklahoma. How much of it do you think was your upbringing?
Well, in terms of politics, almost zero. I mean, it had, look, I'll address my upbringing. I mean, it was very prairie gothic. It was very work ethic orientated. My father was an ex-United States Marine. It was pretty rigorous, physically demanding work most of the time. And somehow I came out of it as a church pianist because of my mother's, efforts in that direction. But in terms of the polarity in the music business, that was something that just came down the pike one day. And I remember talking to David Geffen about it and saying, I don't know, there's so much that I want to do, and I feel like I'm confused about how to create a singer-songwriter role for myself because I'm identified with Glenn Campbell and the Fifth Dimension and to some degree the the traditional, you know, singing community, and he said, "You can't play Vegas." Just like that. Just like, very matter of fact, you know, you can't play Vegas. I had been offered $40,000 a week to play Caesar's Palace, and then they had offered me 8 weeks a year. And in those days, that was a fortune. Elvis Presley was making $250,000 a week at the International, so that wasn't too bad for a songwriter from Oklahoma. And I turned it down. I turned it down and went on the road with, together we made a quartet, a three-piece band, and I played piano and played the Bitter End, the Main Point, Philadelphia, the Cellar Door in Washington, D.C., Marvelous Marv's in Denver. Played the Troubadour in L.A. many, many, many times. And, you know, just to be honest with you, try to get my credentials in order. It was not that easy. It was not that easy to do, and I didn't seem to... anyway, look, you know, the book has ups and it has downs, but that was one of the times when I feel that I was really struggling.
With that said, success came early to you. I mean, you were a teenager, and you were doing very well.
I was doing well. I was doing well from a financial perspective. If that's the only way you measure yourself or measure your life, I'm sure that a lot of people would have been content with where I was. And there's no doubt in my mind that I would possibly even have a boat as big as David Geffen's if I had stayed in the middle of the road and cranked out those hits. But that I had some crazy idea that I wanted to be an artist. And I, you know, one, you know, bright morning, I got up out there in paradise in Southern California and said, I want to be an artist. And that's the road I took. And I think I made it clear in the book that I think that that was the right decision to make. The problems that I ran into were largely of my own making. I started out flirting with marijuana, and when cocaine came into the record business as a commanding presence and an alternative currency, it affected everything from sex to studio musicians to the executives who were running the labels, and it did so with great impact from the early 70s and well into the 80s. If not the 90s. I mean, it was a tremendous hammer blow to the whole industry. And even record promotion was conducted to some degree with that, with the wampum of cocaine behind it. And, you know, I resisted a little bit. I hooked up with some people who didn't resist at all. And I can remember people saying, cocaine's good for you. Sounds ridiculous today, but, you know, cocaine is good for you. Well, of course it is, you know, because the man doesn't want you to have it. So, you know, it really led to some problems for me. I think it, in spite of my best efforts to sort of live in denial, that eventually I was I was somewhat substance dependent, and I almost destroyed myself on three or four occasions, which I also unsparingly recount in the book. And the book doesn't really end in a sort of redemptive way. It ends with me surviving an encounter with an unintentional encounter with PCP that was almost disastrous. It's not a redemption story because I had many years of struggle and with those kind of problems. I still had those problems and with alcohol, and I could say proudly that I'm completely sober and happily sober, and have been for, it'll be 18 years. But you know, the book is raw. I mean, it tells it like it is.
Let's talk a little bit about the music and the songs that you are so associated with, in the sense that when you look at that, at the list and the artists that you work for, there, it is amazing of how eclectic those artists are.
My approach to music was always that all good music was worthwhile, and I'm still very stubborn about that. I've resisted, at least spiritually resisted, the current tendency to create discrete universes of listeners, a universe where we only listen to rap, or we only listen to country, or we only listen to classical. I loved the top 40 of the late 60s and at least most of the 70s, where the Weavers might have a record in the playlist alongside Whisperin' Bill Anderson, and that might be followed by the Supremes, and that might be followed by Cher, and that might be followed by the Beatles, and then something by the Jefferson Airplane. I think that that diversity was a real American thing, and not in the, battle hymn of the Republic sense of the of an American thing, but in the sense of a true democracy where everybody had a voice. And I thought it was good for the populace. It was good for people to hear other people's music. And they were all on an equal playing field. It was a meritorious system, 40 records, the 40 most popular records. It didn't matter what color they were. It didn't matter if it was a Bud Shank instrumental or whatever it might happen to be, or Dick Dale. It was legit if it was on the chart. So I've carried that through my whole life. I've always loved jazz. I still love jazz. I used to play the Bitter End in New York when I was touring as a wannabe songwriter, singer-songwriter. And I loved playing the Bitter End because a lot of times Bill Evans would be playing at top of the Village Vanguard, and I would sneak over there on my breaks and order a hamburger and just sit in the back and listen to Bill Evans. I'm crazy about classical music. What I listen to, what I spend a lot of time listening to, particularly as I've grown older, I listen to a lot of classical music and take a lot of inspiration from it. Oh, in fact, I just wrote a nocturne for piano and orchestra. It's been played twice, once in Kentucky and once on Long Island. That's what I am. I mean, I live and breathe diversity, so when I felt myself being jammed into a certain slot, like almost like Jimmy Webb, the band leader, I mean, it was like really uncomfortable for me. I ran like a rabbit because that's not who I was. And I think, apropos of your question, if you look at my discography, one will see almost every kind of music represented there.
Yeah, it's actually one of the most fun parts of the book, all the lists in the end of your songs and the artists that you worked for, and you certainly see that in that. You were mentioning classical music and listening to it now. I mean, that was something that you came to. You brought classical arrangements to pop songs. That was unique.
It may not be fair to say it was unique because I was a disciple of George Martin and a Beatle worshiper, and I was very much aware of the sort of high tone of some of George's arranging. For instance, the kind of Mozart-like scherzo that accompanies Eleanor Rigby, the string quartet that is Yesterday, and then some of the larger symphonic pieces that really started with John Lennon sort of demanding that he wanted it to sound like the end of the world, unquote. Or George Harrison saying, I want it to sound like a man singing on a mountain 30 miles away from here. And somehow George would work it up with Jeffrey Emmerich, who was the other genius in the room. I think that some of that music is classical music. I think that one of these days it will be regarded with the same awe as classical music. Day in the Life might be one. So I was really just, in my mind, keeping the faith and the spark that had really been ignited with Pet Sounds. And then definitely, I know this from George, I know that he described Sgt. Pepper as an attempt, and I'm using quotes now, as an attempt to equal Pet Sounds, unquote. So that's the provenance of that. And so when I got to the table and it was my turn, I couldn't wait to do some classical rock fusion, you know, and to be given an assignment like MacArthur Park by Bones Howe. He said, just write a piece that really has different movements. You know, I said, really? How long? And he says, as long as you want. That was an amazing thing to fall in my lap. I tried my very best to take advantage of it.
There will be another song for me, for I will sing it. There will be another dream for me, someone will bring.
What is a song like that? What is, like MacArthur Park, what does that mean to you now when you look back on it, even as you were putting the book together, realizing that that's such a touchstone?
Well, I have my images that are, you know, very real, very personal, very warm. They're fleshed out. There's the girl I was in love with. There was a park where we had lunch frequently, and where we sort of harangued our way through the end of our relationship, and where I saw virtually everything that's, you know, that's mentioned in the lyrics. So to me, when I hear it, I don't bat an eye. I'm not wrinkling up my forehead trying to figure out what it means. But I think that some people have been perplexed by it. And I understand that, but I think that you to understand it, you have to look around at songs like A Whiter Shade of Pale, songs like Strawberry Fields, so Don McLean's The Day the Music Died, a lot of Bob Dylan's contemporary work. And you see that, and especially some of the stuff coming out of Haight-Ashbury, that lyrics weren't literal. They mean different things to different people, just like notes mean different things to different people. I mean, when I hear What'll I Do, I see an image, I see a person, I see a place. I know that everybody sees something, but I know that it's different. It's always a different picture. So I used to try to explain it, and I realized this is like a thankless job. I always had a sense of humor about MacArthur Park. I signed off on Don Novello's version in character as Father Guido Sarducci, which I thought was hilarious. I signed off on Weird Al Yankovic's Jurassic Park, which was a video for MTV. I laughed with everybody else in Airplane 2 when it drives a whole host of would-be airline passengers out of an elevator in a panic. So I always had a sense of humor about it. It's just that I found that there were some people who didn't.
Do you feel that there, and this seems like almost an impossible question, but do you feel that there is a song that encompasses some of your best work?
That's the dreaded list question. And it's a very, very hard one for me. But there are songs that I can say this and with absolute conviction, and I want to be truthful with you, that I have some songs that I like better than others that I'm especially proud of. And one of them is "The Moon Is a Harsh Mistress," Judy Collins and Arif Mardin's version of that beautiful string arrangement by Arif Mardin, which is just, you just don't think about Arif doing that, but he was quite the orchestra guy.
Once the sun did shine, good Lord, it felt so fine. The moon, a phantom rose, over the mountains and the pines. Then the darkness fell. The moon's a harsh mistress. It's hard to love her well.
I still think that Wichita Lyman is almost nearly a perfect record. It is such an eloquent matching of vocal texture and lyric and melody. And I'm not bragging about my contribution. I'm just saying it turned out that way. Like so much stuff on record, it just happens a certain way. And that one I think very highly.
I hear you singing in the wire. I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
I'm very proud of my song, Highwayman.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side.
You know, I still think it was an excellent idea, incorporating four lives into four verses of this thing. And then the matching of that song, which was really done by Glenn. He took that song to Waylon Jennings, Chris Christopherson, Johnny Cash, and Willie Nelson. And so that was just kind of a brilliant thing altogether. That was a tour de force. I won a Grammy for Best Country Song. It was a number one country music video. It created a super group, the Highwaymen, who played together for decades. So, you know, I mean, there are definitely high spots, but I can't grab one song and say if I had to carry this baby out of the burning building, it would be my, you know, it would be this one.
The name of the memoir is The Cake and the Rain. It is published by St. Martin's Press. You should be very proud of this as well.
Well, Joe, I'm proud that I was able to get through the process. It's not for the faint of heart. I wrote 300,000 words, and I watched it whittled down to 120, which is probably the worst part of the whole thing. My father was a finisher, and I think he would have been proud of the fact that I didn't throw up my hands and run away from this. And there were times when I did feel like doing it, but my father is very much in that book. His spirit lies over that book. I lost him last year. He was 94, and one of the regrets I have about that is that he didn't actually get to see this book published.
Well, it is a beautiful memoir. It is The Cake and the Rain. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Jimmy Webb, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Great
well,
pleasure.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your program. It's just one of my favorites.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, Jimmy Webb is the author of The Cake and the Rain. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
I fly a starship across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain. But I will remain, and I'll be back again and again and again.